presentation I'll give you is a little bit of a mix of what you've seen from everybody thus far. The Northwest, in terms of climate forecast, is a lot like the Northeast in terms of possibly many more opportunities than challenges. That said, we're also like the desert Southwest in terms of our complete reliance on water to make anything work. And so what I'm going to do is kind of walk through a presentation that gives the story of what's happened at WSU and the program that I've worked to develop with others, focused in this area, not just of climate change and uncertainty and resiliency, but kind of all these big challenges that are happening and really is done under a climate banner. We started about in 2003 with funding from the Paul Allen Family Foundation, so the Microsoft co-founder. And what you'll get a flare of, especially in our early work, is a really high energy technology presence in our work. And that comes from the fact that the guy that wants to build a spaceship on his own rather than with government support is the one that really initiated our funding. So, you know, a little bit of framing. Like I said, it's not just about climate change, but it's about kind of all these convening issues that are challenging the sustainability of agriculture in our region and around the world, but clearly climate is the lens that we're doing a lot of the work under. So that first project funded by the Allen Foundation really focused on three areas: reducing direct agricultural greenhouse gas emissions, restoring soil carbon, and then, like I said, the real energy technology heavy piece of replacing fossil fuels with biomass. All of this was framed in a context of doing this work under a changing climate, and so needing agricultural systems that could be adapted into the future, even though we were looking at emissions reductions. So, you know, from there we've got a lot more work that's been done, quite a bit more funding that's come in, a lot of partnerships between Washington State University, University of Idaho, Oregon State University, and USDA in this area. One of the projects, REACH project, that I'll talk a little bit more about, we did some work surveying the inland Northwest wheat growers, primarily dryland producers, but also irrigated producers, and kind of asked them the same set of questions of, you know, climate change happening? Do you believe it's happening? What's the cause? But where I thought it was really the most interesting was getting at, you know, where does a producer see risk in their operation? And what we did is we presented them with a map that forecasted one realization of climate change at mid-century. And it said, given this realization, how would you respond to these questions? And essentially assess your risk of, you know, no risk to high risk or uncertainty. Fewer days with frozen soil, increased intensity of precipitation, less reliable precipitation. And, you know, kind of all of those fit in this category of, you know, it could be a high risk for some producers, but a lot of, you know, moderate risk for some producers in terms of could they manage the climate change forecasted in that map prescription of what that future would look like. But what's really interesting is then we said, what about climate change policies, long-term drought, unstable crop prices, and cost of inputs? And you see a lot more uncertainty on those answers or high risk on those answers. And that's pretty consistent with what we've experienced, both informally and formally through various different advisory processes and other surveys. In our region, our producers really don't care about climate change as a whole in terms of the trend of trajectory of difference from the actual management side. They care a lot more about, drought, long-term drought is the one thing they care about. They care a lot more about policy and regulation and how that might affect their ability to farm going forward. So another one, we asked these same producers with that same map in their hands, if you were faced with those changes presented above, what amount of change are you likely to make? And the blue and yellow bars is basically no change or small changes. And I guess that's kind of orange up there, and red are moderate changes to big changes. And then we said, in your cropping system, in your rotation, in your tillage practices, in your soil conservation practices, and then in crop insurance purchasing. And again, our producers, on at least in response to this, largely said, we don't think we're going to make a whole lot of changes, except for the high risk one, they doubled their crop insurance changes. But, you know, we first looked at this and thought, you know, is that because they either don't understand, don't believe, that kind of thing? Or is it because they think they have sufficient flexibility within their existing management systems? There is some follow-up work that's been done to this, but we've come down to the conclusion that they largely think this is within their ability to manage, given their existing flexibility. And I would say from our own research, we think they're probably right. So what does that do in terms of how do you communicate around climate change or uncertainty and extension moving forward in the context of a producer group that, whether or not they believe it, whether or not they attribute it the same way that the science does, that they really don't care because they don't think it's that big of a deal. Okay. So a little bit of a picture of what some of the work has been done over the last almost decade and a half. We started with, you know, the Allen-funded project, but almost immediately we got into, you know, some bigger issues in terms of the biomass to energy and biomass to fertilizer types of things, as well as looking at climate impact assessment work. And that's kind of resulted in a whole series of larger projects that have followed that original project, and I'll talk a little bit more about each of them. And one of the things we did get to about 2 years ago was in working with the stakeholders in the region, largely because a lot of the producers didn't care, you couldn't work at a cropping systems level, you couldn't work with wheat producers, tree fruit producers, and get enough of an audience for anybody to actually care about one of these projects. And so what we did is said, let's actually gather and work together kind of in the same way that Dan talked earlier about and have a regionally based approach to discussing and kind of updating kind of a clearinghouse for information on ag and climate change. So kind of the place that I've gotten to is I've decided that our farmers in our region are pretty good, pretty capable, quite leading thinkers, quite pioneers. Oftentimes they have better ideas than we do. And so rather than looking at this from a top-down perspective, we're going to look at it from a bottom-up perspective and go to them from the perspective of what are the ideas and approaches to adaptation and other things that you think we should be looking at and then further developing. And so kind of three here, Andy's in the room here. He works with Dale Geese, who's a potato producer. Actually, he's not a potato producer anymore. But kind of working in an irrigated system. Eric Odeberg is part of the REACH project. He's a grower on that. That's a dryland wheat grower. And Steve Vanderhawk is a dairy producer in Western Washington with a completely different set of problems and challenges that are actually much more like the upstate New York problems of too much water when you don't want it, and again, but not enough water when you do need it. And Steve was the first dairy farmer in the state of Washington. I think he was about 25 years old when he installed an anaerobic digester just home to the farm. So these are some of the producers we've worked with, and we've really focused on working with these kinds of leaders in terms of giving us things that are interesting, because climate change really is about a long-term trend. And so if we're talking about extension, we're talking about investment, an investment time horizon as opposed to an annual crop management horizon. Lots of people in the system do annual crop management work, weather work, that kind of thing, and we've really tried to focus on, no, let's think about this investment horizon as the types of decisions we're going to support and trajectories we're going to try and facilitate. So I'm going to start with the dairy one. We've really focused on using biomass energy platforms as kind of the basis for thinking about dairy farming in the future. In the West, we don't have a lot of small dairies left. They're getting bigger and bigger, just like here in the Arizona area, where, you know, our average dairy in Washington State is quite big, and if you add in Idaho, we get a lot bigger. And so we've really focused on the idea of technology to manage manure, both from the perspective of air quality emissions, atmospheric emissions, but mostly from the perspective of nutrient management. And so instead of thinking of a dairy as just a dairy, we've called this concept the biorefinery, or the dairy-based biorefinery, of you would, you know, bring in feed and other things like that, feed the cows, produce milk and other high quality products. But then you'd also look at the manure side of that equation and take that manure as well as food processing waste, which we have a lot of in our state and they tend to be co-located with our dairies, process that through an anaerobic digester, create methane. If you know anything about the Northwest, you know we have a lot of water in our rivers and a lot of hydropower. And what that means is we have really cheap electricity. And so, you know, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to take manure and convert it to electricity and sell it at 2 cents or 1.5 cents per kilowatt hour. Until I moved about a year and a half ago, my residential electric rate was 1.8 cents per kilowatt hour. So that gives you a sense that that just doesn't work. So we've been focused on actually upgrading that gas to other uses like renewable natural gas, because transportation fuels, kind of just the opposite of electricity, in our region are quite expensive relative to the norm. And there is a big project that I just heard is going to get inked in about a month looking at actually doing this in the state of Washington. And then we've done a lot of work. In fact, the vast majority of the work we've done has focused around taking that manure and the other co-digested waste and actually recovering fertilizers out of it and trying to get those fertilizers out in replacement of synthetic fertilizers or other fertilizers from a water quality perspective in some of our watersheds that are really tightly managed. One of the things we've done with NIFA support is, now that we've done, you know, almost 15 years of work in this area, we know some things that we didn't know 15 years ago, and so we've actually built a whole series of extension publications that we actually call an anaerobic digestion systems manual that is mostly available today. This is not just regionally relevant, it's relevant for the entire country and the world. We've built a lot of these projects. We've worked directly with the private industry, and I think in the region we've built about 21 of these. It's well over $100 million in capital invested. We've also actually worked with the technology providers and supported building outside of our region. And we've done a lot of work on the nutrient recovery side and built some pilot and some commercial nutrient recovery facilities both here in the Northwest as well as outside of the region. This is where we're really focused right now, is those fertilizers I've talked about getting the nitrogen and the phosphorus out of the manure and back into the cropping systems. Since we are a specialty crop-driven state, we don't want manure in our fruits and vegetables. And yet, we want some of the benefits of the manure in the fruits and vegetables, and we certainly want better nutrient balances in our watersheds. And so what we've really focused on is not just can we pull nitrogen and phosphorus out of manure, but can we pull it out and put it in a form that is ready to use in the cropping systems and that, you know, looks like any other fertilizer you'd purchase. And we're working with a berry producer right now looking at some of those materials in a raspberry production system. So switching to our dry land system, the regional approaches to climate change project. If you were here yesterday, you might have seen Sanford Eigenbrod present this project as an overall. I'm going to talk specifically about two things my group has done on that. One of them is a focus on essentially a set of case studies, which include both video-based almost teasers as well as, you know, a really durable product. And what we did is we tried to find producers, again, who were on the cutting edge, and both Eric Odeberg, who I showed earlier for Precision Agriculture, and Dale Geese, who is the farmer in the mustard field. We've done case studies on the two of them. You know, about 25 years ago, case studies were a key thing to getting a lot of the no-till to happen in the Northwest region, and we decided let's go do that again, kind of upgrade the models. And I think we've got about 12 of these, but we opted to focus each one of them on a very different different technology application or climate issue that they were dealing with, and kind of had that's the kind of the spread of those. The other major effort we're currently in the middle of, which will be done by February 14th of 2017, whether we want it or not, is essentially a handbook for conservation agriculture in the context of climate change in the inland Northwest. This is a massive undertaking, and I never want to do anything like it again. There's 12 chapters. There's probably about 60 co-authors in each chapter, or in total. It was an exhaustive approach to kind of coalesce everything we know about these systems, frame it in the context of what is the climate change implication for the future, and then put it out there in growers' hands. And one of the interesting things is I'm kind of a digitally oriented person. I'd rather just we put it online, but one of the co-authors really advocated that we actually put this in a book so it can go on the dashboard, so we will print it. Now I'm going to move into some of our more ivory tower projects, and hopefully nobody hears. Andy, don't tell Jenny I said that. We've done a lot of work with models, modeling climate change in agriculture, and one of my concerns early on is a lot of that work is completely irrelevant to management. It's a lot of kind of cool academic science, but it really doesn't get at the questions of, you know, what would a manager do? And so the role I've played in a lot of these efforts has really been focused on trying to get us to a place where we have a good science question and a good management question, and we build a tool that can do both in one fashion or another. And I've managed a big part of the community engagement process, including resource managers, which could include farmers or industry technology providers or otherwise, policymakers, and then we've also included advocacy groups in this work. If you know anything about the Northwest, you know there's these two places called Seattle and Portland that pretty much define policy in the Northwest. Kind of an interesting side note. Washington State today is voting on a ballot initiative on a carbon tax. Up until this point, our ag industry really didn't care about carbon policy issues in our state, and Oregon largely didn't care either, because they felt they could deal with it effectively in the legislature. Ballot initiative blows that up, because at that point in time, if 42% of the people in West King County, which is Seattle, vote for something in our state, it becomes law. And, you know, that kind of implication when most of your agriculture is east of the mountains, you know, 150 to 250 miles away, you know, the industry leadership saw the writing on the wall, and all of a sudden, for the first time ever, are getting really serious about what are they going to do about carbon, because they're all going to be taxed. 50% of the companies on the list of what would get taxed are ag input suppliers and processors. So it's going to hit them really hard, plus the fuel side. And so what we've found is we have to have these groups at the table to have some kind of shared understanding of what we're looking at in order to do any work in terms of an application of a model looking forward that's useful. So we've really taken what, you know, is traditionally an NSF type of effort of, you know, heavy academic modeling, and put this other piece of stakeholder engagement that runs from farmer through agency through environmental group into the process of development. We've actually developed some approaches on how to do that and some ways to actually try and get this influence into this system to actually be effective and efficient and useful in providing some things that we actually produce from an output. It's actually been quite interesting. And so I'm going to kind of go from that kind of conceptual model of BioEarth to one very practical application we've already made, and that is, for the last two rounds, our group has done the Columbia River supply and demand forecast for the state of Washington Department of Ecology. And that is a process that is highly politicized, highly political. There's every stakeholder you can imagine that's in the table, because it's all about the demand for water and who controls it and who gets it. And we've played the role of actually trying to navigate through providing good science to support the decision-making process. The state bonded $200 million of authority to actually start building water projects to solve long-term water problems in our state. For the first time ever, got all those stakeholders to the table and actually working on solutions that can benefit all the different needs. And the key to doing that was to say there would be a process by which science would inform that process. And so we've been doing that. This is the 2011 forecast. The 2016 forecast is currently in the governor's office for review. One of the interesting things this does is it puts you out there sometimes. In fact, I've got a call from a journalist to ask some questions about one of the results that's in this, which says our ag supply or ag water demand is actually forecasted to go down for 20 years, which isn't the thing you want to say in an agricultural region. We just were funded by National Science Foundation in the Food Energy Water Nexus call to kind of take this work to another level. The place that I'm primarily involved is leading this AIM4, again, which is around two-way stakeholder process and engagement to getting research and communication with the real world to actually come up with results that are more effective. I just want to mention this one. It's another NSF-funded project that's led by University of Idaho. It uses that same modeling framework, but is really focused on forest fire. The reason I wanted to bring this one up in the context of extension is there's some really cool stuff we're doing with University of Idaho people on this that are actually video game designers in terms of rethinking how we do education into the future. And then our group is kind of taking on another level of looking at climate visualization and decision tools. We're trying to jump over this short-term weather decision support tool and get to the point of visualizations of the future, and we're trying to get drilled down a little bit further from just climate information to actual crop-specific management and risk information. So one of the things that we've looked at, and this actually came from producers, is you give them a chart that says your yields will go up 10 or 20% or down 10 or 20%, and they shrug their shoulders and say, I don't care. But one of the things we've done is take that same kind of forecast and put it on a map and say, you know, if you're a producer here, by mid-century, this is the area that, your growing conditions will be similar to that. And what we're going to do next is actually look at that from the perspective of not just the climate analog, but what would that mean for the types of crops you grow, and actually do cropping system forecasts, yield forecasts, and quality forecasts. And I mentioned this earlier, there's so much work that's been done in the Northwest now, that it's hard to actually find a lot of this stuff, and so we decided it's kind of like an e-extension community of practice, but it's regionally focused around access to tools and information at one place. And then we did host a workshop with extension, kind of an interesting thing. I think Washington State University has around 25 field or county-based ag extension faculty left. Most of those are not kind of county agents, but they're actually specialists. There's 250 conservation district staff in the state, and there's about 2,500 crop consultants in the state. And so we've kind of shifted from our focus of providing information to extension to conservation districts and crop consultants. And so we had a workshop focused on trying to get to that point where, you know, what are the mechanisms that we could do a better job of getting that information out. And then the last slide I'll show is we've taken a much more kind of consulting role in the last couple of years, where we're getting direct inquiries from either, you know, industry leadership, and actually a PUD who's now looking at this carbon ballot and saying, what does that mean for the implication of their package, technology developers, and then DNR. So Department of Natural Resources manages over 1 million acres of ag lands in the state of Washington, and we actually just finished a process with them of looking at their portfolio of ag land management in the context of climate change and what things should they be doing differently, and talked a lot about portfolio management of the land base they have as well as securing their water rights. This is not just me. In fact, at this point in time, I'm kind of the minority of the intellectual contribution left. I have a pretty good group that includes hydrologic modeler, chemical engineer, programmers, and then some people who really focus on extension work right in the group that is about 98% soft funded. Okay. The obligatory acknowledgement slide. It's not that we don't work with extension. It's that most of our extension faculty they have their own programs. They have their own research program. They have the things they prioritize and focus on. Where it makes sense, we partner and collaborate.
I can see the value.
In terms of... No, I don't think it was tricky at all. It was more just a strategic decision that if if you know, you talk about frontline people that are interacting with producers, well, it's really conservation districts and crop consultants.
Are you seeing a shift toward more digital communication versus face-to-face? Africa extensions really, World Bank's really disappointed in what they're doing. Like in Niger, they're looking at doing extension using mobile phones and the cost savings. Mm-hmm. It, you know, it may not serve all purposes, but it certainly increases efficiency.
We've done across the board everything from live interaction to webinars to digital products to decision tools. It's kind of an all of the above type of approach. Washington's a little interesting in that we have some very large agricultural interests, and oftentimes you get a lot of mileage with a few conversations explaining in detail what the research says, and they have a lot of competency within their own operations to handle that.
The question related to why we still run water down furrows for vegetable production as compared to using some kind of pressurized system. Here's a couple of things that have come out of that study in Yuma. First, by shortening those rows and compacting that ground, they get that water down to an efficiency level that's approaching 80%, which is getting not too far off what most of the sprinkler type work we see going on down there. Now, all of that vegetable production today is germinated using sprinklers. In the old days, if you think about waste, in the old days, those fields were flooded for 5 to 7 days till the seeds germinated. That was the cost of getting rid of that extra water through the drains was what was really the expense. Today it's all sprinkler germinated. Some of it is grown year-round sprinkler on wide beds, some of the leaf lettuces and some. Others, they still prefer to use the furrow system with level basins and no tailwater. And could it be more efficient? Yes. The pressures that are on them are to go to drip, but the drip problem with the salinity is a huge issue to them that they won't go down that path. We are seeing an increase in the number of people using solid set irrigation year for the entire crop now, but it's not widespread. I would say maybe 10 or 15% of the acreage down in the Yuma area has some form of pressurized system year-round now.
Higher variability, so that's exposing them more to catastrophic crop failure. And the commodity markets took some of that fluctuation out, so the farmers, you know, selling. Which now, can insurance actually be a driver for better management? Because if you really go out and say, hey, I'm going to go for the long season crop, but that exposes me to greater risk, then you're going to pay for it in terms of crop insurance. Because they're saying, hey, you're taking a risky route.
So the question is about crop insurance. I think actually that was part of a conversation we had before my talk. I don't think I actually had that as part of my talk. But anyway, I work with crop insurance both in this country and also in places like East Africa. And, a lot of interesting things to say about that. The biggest issue with crop insurance in this country is making sure there's incentives for farmers to adapt to climate change and not just count on crop insurance to bail them out year after year. So I think built into the current farm bill, in terms of some of the major world food crops like corn and wheat, those kind of things, and the crop insurance they get, is if they go back to the well over and over year after year with the same chronic problem, oh, once again I didn't get enough rain, or once again I had too much flooding, their insurance payment is reduced. So that's one way to build an incentive there for farmers adapting. So there can be this perverse effect of crop insurance that it actually slows down the pace of adaptation. What I'm working with some people, Clive Trezza at University of Florida and some others, is crop insurance in developing countries where it's really not built on the old model of, which is very expensive for the insurer and for the insured, is where you really have people go out to the farms after a disaster and assess the impact and make estimates and, you know, hand-to-hand kind of pay the farmer by farmer. It relies more, and you can only do this with a few crops where you have really fairly reliable models, but with a crop like corn, we have good models. And you go to a region and you develop... You tweak, let's say, a corn model for a particular region where there's a lot of corn grown, and you put in some weather stations there, and the insurer has to develop good confidence in their model that, based on the weather station data, their crop model predicts pretty accurately what's happening in terms of yields in a region. Then farmers, then you can go to the farmers with an insurance program where the farmers pay a smaller premium than they would for typical insurance, because nobody's ever going to come out to their farm and see what happened after, let's say, a dry year. So let's say there is a dry year and the crop model predicts reduced yields, let's say 30% yield reduction. So all the farmers in the sphere from the weather station that predicted reduced yields get a payment attributable to that 30% reduction in yields that the model predicted. Now, if you're a farmer who's adapted, let's say you've done a lot of work to build up the organic matter in soils, so you have better water holding capacity, you might have only had a 5% yield reduction. You get the same payment. It's back. Actually, you win. So it really promotes quite a significant incentive. And the premiums for the farmer are very low, because it's a very low overhead. Once the climate, there's this initial homework that has to be done to develop the climate model, confidence in the climate model by the insurer, because obviously the people who are doing this insuring can lose their shirts if they're, you know, they could be paying out when they shouldn't be, et cetera. So it involves sort of a transition period of often having some grants subsidized as this thing gets going, or government subsidized the idea. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's what I kind of know about crop insurance. Okay.
Could be for any of the speakers. What do you think? We could wake up tomorrow and have a president who's going to not necessarily believe in climate change.
Well, actually believe it's a hoax, right?
Yeah. So I guess my question is, is the current extension model extending to the right people? Or should it be a broader extension? Should it go to the general public and policymakers more? And what in your collective programs are you doing to help extend that concern beyond just the farmers, but perhaps policymakers?
I'll just have to, maybe the other speakers can have some comments on this too. My comment on that would be, well, we do, like I've done several policy briefings in D.C., so that sort of thing, talking about what it could mean for agriculture and food security in this country. And some of the opportunities as well as the negatives about climate change if this country's really on top of the whole thing and doesn't bury their head in the sand trying to take advantage of opportunities, maybe increased production of some crops in the high northern parts of the U.S., for example, and things like that. So there's that aspect. But in terms of otherwise, I'm more interested in, I feel like if I bring the farmers up to speed and get over sort of the hurdle of it being so politicized, so that they are concerned about it, that they're quite capable of speaking for themselves if they're convinced it's an issue for them. And I think in the Northeast, I feel like we've been helped, unfortunately, by enough actual impacts of climate change. I mean, farmers are actually seeing some impacts of at least changing weather, they would say. Even the most skeptical of them would say, we're seeing weather patterns like we've never seen on this farm for multiple generations. And so they're concerned about that, and they're trying to do things about it. And I think they're feeling like they're getting some help from us about that. So I just would hope that they would, if that were to come about, they might still, even if they had a leadership at the top that said climate change was a hoax or was not being caused by humans, they would still feel certain that what they've been seeing on their own farm is real, and that they're concerned about adapting to shifts in weather patterns, and they want more information about it. So, I don't know, that's my two cents on that.
I'll add a few statements to that.
I guess my thought, this is a part of the world that's not exactly in tune with climate change politically. But that said, and the point I was trying to make perhaps with my presentation is it doesn't really matter now out here. Water is short. It probably will never be back to the way it was 25 years ago out here. And it has been a climate shift that's driven it. Now, I think, and I'll be honest with you, I've talked to farmers for 32 years out here. I've been asked in front of very conservative farm audiences by farmers this year for the first time, what about this climate change? Is this all real? And you respond to them. And I think we're at a tipping point with our agricultural folks. I agree with what was just said. If they come to a conclusion that certain aspects of what they're dealing with are climate change that is heading in a direction they've never seen before, may never see again, they have the political clout, especially out here, to drive the politics of this state and perhaps in this region. The farmers in this region are huge, large capitalized folks. They can drive policy. The reason they haven't been hurt as bad, if you have 4.2 million people in Phoenix and you've got really 500 farming operations in this state that are irrigating, and they haven't had their water assaulted, they've got some power, and if they decide this climate thing is real, and they're getting there, then I think the policy works back up the chain. That's my take.
So I'll respond a little bit, and very similar kind of situation to Arizona with the caveat that kind of the state-driven politics are the opposite of Arizona, you know. And so our industry leaders see it doesn't matter what they think at all. They're going to have to deal with it. Their concern is that the policies and regulations that get put in place understand their systems and are actually flexible and not just punitive to their systems. And so they're at the table.
Yeah, so I'm from Georgia, so completely different perspective, more similar to here. But I was just at a coastal Georgia climate change sea level rise meeting last week, and the sportsmen were there, Trout Unlimited, deer hunters, and they're, you know, very, and this guy stood up and said, I'm the most conservative person you're ever going to meet, but this is real. My trout are dying. So that was, like, shocking to all of us in the room. There's 200 people in the room, and there was, like, this collective gasp, like, whoa, this guy's on our side. So maybe these realities are finally going to hit the right people. This guy was obviously very influential in the state, running Trout Unlimited. I mean, he probably fishes with our governor or something like that. So, yeah, I mean, reality is going to take care of it, right, eventually? Let's hope. I don't know.
Just one more comment I might have about that. I think
in New York City, we find that the farmers are easily as afraid of climate change policy, you know, the reaction to climate change in terms of the policy change that might adversely affect them as they are climate change. And where I find myself differing, and I have lots of farmer friends, and I've got lots of interesting discussions with them about this, where I find myself differing with them is they have like absolute certainty that if they give any credence to climate change, the policy is going to be horrible for them. Mm-hmm. And I point out that there's two senators from every big ag state. You know, I just don't see that happening. And if they could get involved, I think, and make sure there aren't policies that are going to be so negative for them. And they have lower certainty than I have in some of the climate change projects. Like some of them are really confused by some of the misinformation that you know, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is some kind of conspiracy cooked up by France or something. You know. So when they, you know, we try to give them, you know, good accurate information about levels of certainty about climate change projections, but they have an exaggerated sense of those uncertainties, and then an exaggerated certainty about how horrible policies would be if we had a government that was really active about trying to make build climate change resilience, with farming and all the
Well, it was a town order. You had a graph of Chad Kruger. It basically, I think you said too that they really don't care. I mean, is that alarming? I mean, the graph said that they really didn't. They thought they were in pretty good shape or felt safe. They felt what they were doing was okay, and that they would be able to mitigate any of the problems.
So the respondents to the survey were inland Northwest wheat growers spread across a very large region. That region also already has significant heterogeneity. Everything from Waterville farmers at 6 inches of rain to east of Moscow at almost 30 inches of rain. So it's already this very significant spread. And it kind of blocks up into zones. Most of the producers are well within a zone, and a little bit of shift, you know, a couple of degrees and an inch or two of precipitation isn't that big of a deal. Those that are already kind of on the margin of a zone and might be needing to fallow an extra year, you know, that could actually explain some of the we really think we're going to need to change is because we're already trying to push the limits, and basically the forecast you've given us says trying to push what we're trying to push isn't going to work. Whereas for most of them, they have a lot of flexibility already. The same thing goes in our irrigated region, though, that your vulnerability is site-specific, and it's based on where your water's coming from, how high elevation your snowpack is, and which water right you have within that basin. And so we've got producers that, you know, their water is secure forever, and it doesn't matter to them. And then we have producers who every other year are dealing with curtailment. And so you look at this package, and then the question is, if you're dealing with curtailment every other year, do you grow tree fruit? Probably not. You know, you grow a crop that you can fallow out of. And so I think, you know, the more we've looked at it, the more we think that's probably actually a pretty intelligent response by the producers, that your vulnerability is site-specific.
I would just add, I think that the important thing is that farmers, I think farmers are pretty confident about their ability to adapt to climate change. The important thing is just make sure all farmers are at a point where they're listening to the best climate change information available to them. Like we, you know, in our region, we say, you know, it's ridiculous to think about building a new dairy barn and build it on the heat specs of yesteryear, because that, we know that time is gone. And why would you build a new barn and not have cooling capacity for the climate and the weather situation that, you know, the cows are going to be dealing with for the next 50 years? So our barn is a long-term investment. So, but if a farmer's not, you know, doesn't believe in climate change and doesn't want to look at anything that has to do with climate change, they would ignore that. So you have two farmers, and one could do quite fine, simply with maybe even just changing where they top the orientation of the farm, and some minor shifts, and another might really make a ridiculous investment decision and build a farm that's going to create example, the key thing we want to do is make sure our extension folks and our farmers are not, have got over this politicization to the least extent. They listen to what some objective, the best information we can provide, and let them make the decision.
I concur with that, and that's why, you know, as I said at the end, we're moving towards trying to provide some kind of decision aid or visualization tool that has probabilities associated based on the crop and the location that you're growing it, to give them better forecasts from, you know, we've got the capability to do it, but historically we haven't put that kind of information out there. A tree fruit producer will dump $60,000 to $70,000 an acre into a new orchard planting, and 2 years later rip it out because the market changed for the fruit. You know, we want to minimize those kinds of downside losses on an investment time horizon and make sure that, you know, you don't plant tree fruit expecting a 30-year time horizon in a place you're not going to have water supply. And they're, you know, by and large, our producers have been very responsive to what we put out there. So we probably need somebody from Iowa to really answer this question.
Well, I think it just, you know, Arizona is not a big agricultural state by any definition, but this is, was a traditionally a cotton state. It's hard to find cotton here anymore. They changed the farm bill, converted into insurance, and basically insurance instead of payment plan, and that accelerated the departure of cotton from this state. And so what you're saying happened. Now, what's happened to us is the dairy industry keeps growing and alfalfa comes in, and from a water perspective, it's actually a negative for us to have all this forage being grown here. But you got all these people sitting up here demanding dairy products. So, but from the point of view, that's, if you talk to our economists, they will all say that that change in the farm bill took cotton from being a price supported, put an end for goods. Another nail in the so-called cotton production. We're down to 120,000 acres, 600,000
Vicky behind you could probably answer this as well as anybody, but it's basically the same in Washington State. Wheat producers are weaned off of it, and our specialty crop producers completely ignore the farm bill. They don't care. You know, with the payment limitations, even when there were commodity programs, the payment limitations are so small relative to their size, it's more hassle for them to do paperwork. So they don't care. Some of them do, and particularly in those really marginal areas like the Waterville Plateau, they do care. But it's not the situation it used to be, and it's going the other direction. You know, for instance, the specialty crop growers won a settlement that enabled them to get some similar type of program, and what did they say do with it? Invest it in research. So the industry leadership said, no, our more important advantage from some kind of public subsidization of our industries is give us the R&D to succeed in the future.
Yeah,